Hello, hello, and welcome to the pilot episode of The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think. The Thin Blue Line with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
This week we're going to be looking at the College of Policing and is it relevant to frontline policing? We will also be discussing what is the role of a police officer in 2022 and looking at whether there has been mission creep into other agencies' areas of responsibility. Finally, we will be pulling apart the thorny issue of police well-being. There's a lot to pack in, so, constables, to your duties. The Thin Blue Line with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Welcome to the pilot episode, I suppose, of this new podcast. Richard, what have you brought to the table?
Well, I brought one of the knotty and unresolved issues of policing, the College of Policing itself. I'm here neither to bury it or to praise it, but just to raise some of the issues and perhaps discuss some of the issues around this body that's been with us now for a decade. If you cast your mind back, 2012, 2013, there was an ambition, I think, to roll the National Policing Improvement Agency, the National Police Library, various other bodies, all into one organisation and call it the College of Policing. It was a Home Office-led and inspired piece of police reform. A limited company with an ambition to be an independent statutory body, which a decade on was still not there. So we have a number of retired chief constables that have been running the College of Policing as the CEO the whole of its existence. And we end up in February of this year with a report of a fundamental review into the College of Policing, which has been taken forward by Nick Herbert, former policing minister, and Andy Marsh, current incumbent as chief executive officer for the college. And it was interesting to me that a decade on, rather than sort of celebrating the success in the way the college might have embedded itself within policing and within the training, it's undergoing a fundamental review. And that seems to me to be of a piece with what's happened to it over the decade. I remember when the college first started to try and promote itself to the rank and file, the front line of policing. There were various roadshows through the country and there was obviously quite a lot been spent on College of Policing pens. The College of Policing pens at this first contact with policing had blue ink. Those of you outside of policing may know we never use blue ink. You have your pocket notebook, you have your detective's big blue book. Nobody in policing uses blue ink. And it just, for me, it's been sort of emblematic of the way that the whole thing started. They didn't really understand the marketplace, because if you did, if anybody that was involved in frontline policing had looked at these pens, they'd have said, the blue, nobody will use them. I've still got mine. It's got very low mileage on it. You go through there and then you spend a decade looking at what's happened with the college. And the fundamental review says it still doesn't have a strong or a clear role. It does authorise professional practice. It's done work around the police qualifications framework, the various degree apprenticeships and the degree entry and the degree holder entry. It's done work around direct entry at superintendents and inspectors. It's done the authorised professional practice. It's tried to promote the library that it's inherited as part of its foundation. But the fundamental review says it still doesn't have a strong or clear role out in policing, that there's poor communication between the college and those that it would want to serve, and that it still doesn't really understand the front line of policing.
Which is a bit worrying, really, isn't it, when you think about it, when they're there to introduce policy into frontline policing and yet they don't understand its role.
What is its purpose? I know you're saying that it's struggling to have an identity, but what is its purpose and what is its mission?
It's currently, I think, around implementing standards in policing in England and Wales. Whether that standards, they see themselves as the the repository for the Code of Ethics, the Police Code of Ethics as well, which we're held to. They see themselves as a repository for authorised professional practice in various areas where they put out, this is the way you should do it, sort of guidance documents.
We had that with the MPIA. I know from my background within firearms, they were very, very stringent, and the MPIA worked very well from my point of view within firearms. So we had that, didn't we?
We did.
But it wasn't called college, and I think, personally, there was a bit of a drive to try and get it into a professional body, a bit like doctors, paramedics and other public services.
Sure. It's not a royal college yet, but it's a college. And certainly when you look at the initial discussions and documentation around it, it has this ambition to be an independent statutory body, to be, for want of a better phrase, a proper college. Where its funding comes from is always the difficult question with that, because it's currently doing about 70, 80 million a year from government funding, I believe, and bits of contributions, training Saudis, you know, all sorts of bits and pieces that they do. But the operating budget is 77 million this year.
That's more than the HMI, isn't it?
I don't know.
But I mean, certainly, and I think the reviews highlighted it, and I know the college were the first to admit it, that the communication between college and the police forces has been pretty poor, really, hasn't it?
Well, the proof of that is if you speak to the average cop at any rank in any department and say, it's a bit like the famous sketch, what's the College of Policing ever done for me?
Yeah.
Isn't it? And are they imposing things upon me? Or have they actually made my working day better? But there's a health warning to that. Sometimes you cannot see the gradual, incremental changes that are making your working life better. Sometimes you just can't see it because of other noises. I get that. But that's the question I would ask. What's its purpose? What does it self-determine itself to be and its purpose? And what's the college ever done for me that the MPIA didn't?
And I don't think that's an unfair questions to ask, is it? Because those are the questions people are asking, and the college have admitted that we've not been very good in communicating that. But perhaps we're still waiting for an answer.
If that answer comes, it may be difficult. Other things that were noted in this, I say again, fundamental review, which again, you're a decade down the line and already you're into a fundamental review. It's not existential, but it's...
But it's open enough to be able to expose itself to it then.
Yeah,
it is. You know, you've got to give them credit for that. They can't say, well, we're only 10 years old, so therefore we're ploughing on and we'll review it in another 10 or a 25-year mark.
They didn't sugar the pill, that's for sure. Yeah. They didn't. They recognise that some of the training they provided has been of poor quality. If we think back to... It's a police acronym, NCALT. I still don't know what it stands for. But NCALT was an online training system for bobbies. You'd log on to a computer and you'd get training that really wasn't very good, almost like PowerPoint-based. It was not great. That, again, doesn't help with your credibility when bobbies are logging on to look at your product and they're not really happy with it. It doesn't look professional, it doesn't feel professional. And it's online training, which is fine for some things, but there's some things you just can't replicate, Mark One being there or being talked through it, that sort of live experiential learning.
You need expert subject matters in front of a class or in front of a group of people who are going to be able to respond to all the different learning styles and say, there's a question here, this is my answer. The idea of NCAL I quite like, because you get things out to a lot of people very quickly, and what are those changes? Because the changes to pace, massive changes to pace over the last couple of years, rolled out on NCAL, and you'd think, well, that's a way of getting all that information out very quickly, and it can be a reference source, etc., etc. But what actually happens with busy cops on the street who cannot deal with their own workload, it becomes an albatross around the neck, doesn't it? And it becomes a thing of they're getting chased by the supervisor, get this done, get this done, get this done. So you end up, and tell me if anyone else has done this, you end up setting it off playing and you're doing other things because...
You won't be the first to have done that and you certainly won't be the last.
I don't think that was a cough, Dave, to be honest. I was putting it out there to see if anyone else had.
And you were just testing the water, weren't you?
Yeah,
dipping your toes in.
Yeah.
But you've hit the nail on the head, haven't you? It's time. You know, cops just have not got the time to do it. And there isn't the money, I suspect, to provide specific bespoke training on these new topics. It's a cheap way of teaching, I think.
Yeah, it's a great idea if it's rolled out right, because my downtime might be 4 a.m. on a Wednesday. I can listen to that and I can digest it. For you, it might be 7 a.m. on a Sunday. It's whatever. It can be bespoke to you. You cannot get that often, right, that entire shift, or that group of people are going to be in that classroom for 8 hours or 3 hours, and we're going to do this. Even on handover times, the priority is always going to be that person ringing up for help.
Absolutely.
And that next emergency job that we need to respond to.
And I suppose we're straying into that awful topic of performance data now, aren't we? And those days look as though they might be coming back, but again, that's perhaps for another day.
So bringing it back to the college then, the college must have this feedback, and the college must have established routes back in to say, how is this working? Is it becoming a useful tool, a reference tool, a bit like the library used to be, or is it becoming a stick to beat officers with? I don't know what the answer is myself.
They've recognised that their systems are, for them to do anything, their internal systems, to change anything, to move anything, are very, very bureaucratic. It's been built on a bureaucracy, right, internally. And that was one of the things that came up in the review. It takes us too long and the systems are too cumbersome for us to react to things.
OK, well, obviously, time, money, it's one of the things that have come out of that, isn't it? Time. Cops do not have time. So, Steve, I think you've got a topic you want to bring now, which very definitely does tie up police with most, if not all, their time, really.
Well, yeah, and I think it comes back to the fundamental question of what is the role of the police officer in 2022? And I think, more importantly, what do the public expect of the police service in 2022? It's always interesting, the big gap between the public and the cops in answering this question. And it's a question I've asked many family and friends recently. And I'm usually met with a quizzical look of, well, don't you know? Isn't it quite obvious? It's arresting bad guys, it's keeping people safe, it's investigating crime, it's enforcing the law. But the thing is, if you ask any police officer, and they would dream of being able to focus on these issues, but there's blockers in the way. And I think we're getting to a point now, and I'm not sure the public are aware of the full role of the police officer of 2022. I personally believe the policing service is at a crossroads and the public aren't aware. And I think we're getting to a point of we need to make a decision. Not the police. I think we as in the public as well, and government and the Home Office. What do you want from the police? I've heard policing being described recently as in a perfect storm. It's a very promotional kind of buzz phrase, but it's more complex demand being serviced by fewer officers. And it's a growing complex international aspect of crime coupled with the reduction of 5.9% of officers. And that's officers in England and Wales. And that's from March 2010 to March 2021. And that's just for me one reason that we need a refocus, because policing has changed. Dixon of Dot Green doesn't exist. And I'll tell you a very quick, funny story. I was doing the party conference at Blackpool and I was part of the ARV crew. I was the sergeant of the team and I was walking around. I had a sidearm on, a ballistic vest, helmet, a carbine weapon. An old lady stops me and says, "You haven't really got any bullets in that, have you?" And she was deadly serious. And this was on Coronation Street at Blackpool.
Flag that come out that went bang.
Yeah. And I said, "Well, yes, yeah." And she was horrified. She was absolutely horrified. And you hear it all the time. Well, you hear it all the time from when you're on the ARV to say, well, we need to get back to Dixon of Dot Green. And I always say, well, Dixon of Dot Green actually got killed in a firearms incident, so hey. But that was the film, wasn't it? So, like I said, that's one reason we need a refocus. But I think the main one is vulnerability and mental health. And that's a big one for me. It's the single factor that has fundamentally changed the role of a police officer over the last 5 to 10 years. A police officer now spends up to 40% of their time dealing with mental health matters. 40% of the time. They also spend a considerable amount of time dealing with children missing from home and from care. And this was reiterated by Andy Cook, who's about to become the new head of HMI. Now, this isn't new. As far back as 2017, Chief Constable Dee Collins told the Home Office Select Committee that 83% of her time in terms of delivering services is not about crime, and referred to real pressures around mental health, real pressures around people missing from home, children and adults. Even Sir Tom Windsor, who has had some grief from the front line,
he's had a bit of a change of heart, hasn't he, is Tom Windsor?
Yeah, is there a little bit of retirement approaching, say, what you can? Or it's a matter of, has he been convinced? That might be it. Has he been exposed to it so much that he's been convinced? Because he himself has said that these pressures were too often making the police the service of first resort, long after the chances of effective prevention have been lost. He declared this a profoundly improper way to treat vulnerable people who need care and help, and said, until mental health is given the same priority as physical health in resources, including funding, the police will continue to play too large a role dealing with people with mental health problems. And that is from the outgoing head of Her Majesty's Inspector. So with little time available for the reduction, prevention, detection of crime that my mum wants the police to do, the question I ask is, what is the road ahead for policing? And are the public aware?
About 10 years ago, I used to write a blog back in the day. I coined a phrase, the paramilitary social worker of last resort. It was back then I could see that it was coming, that the partner bodies that we had in mental health and social care, in children's social care, in the hospitals, didn't have the capacity that they had. And so they were falling more and more onto allowing things with their clients to get to a point where there's an emergency intervention needed, and it needed police emergency powers like Section 136 of the Mental Health Act to help sort it. I've seen care plans for people that have potential mental health crisis on a regular basis, saying if all else fails, if they're threatening self-harm or to harm others, becoming violent or disturbed, call the police. Knowing that we come, because we have to come. Because we have, you know, it's part of what we do as police, and we're 24/7 and we're out there. And I watched mental health assertive outreach teams wither on the vine because the services were withdrawn as budgets were being cut over the last decade or so. Our partners got down to a much reduced core of service they're able to provide. And part of that, I think, explicit was saying, what we can't do, the police will probably be all right. They'll be able to detain somebody for mental health. They can go look for missing children. They can go look for people who have walked out from accidents and emergency departments or off hospital wards that are at risk. And so that stuff comes thick and fast. And the figures you were saying as a former response sergeant, I absolutely recognise those as the level of demand that goes into a response team in dealing with things that have got nothing to do with crime or disorder or people's quality of life in the place they live. That's a problem. Whether there's a lot can be done about it, I'm always open for decisions, and there's always projects like putting the police and the ambulance together, for example, that's been tried. Mm. Having mental health triage workers in the police communication rooms, that's been tried. I think the reality is we service the 9-5 gap, or the 5-9 gap rather, from 5 o'clock in the afternoon till 9 o'clock in the morning. Often we're it, and at weekends often we're it, and we're stuck policing vulnerability in that gap.
One of the best trials they ever did recently was having the mental health experts in the communications room, because it would ease a lot of the issues, could sometimes get sorted before it even went to you as the response sergeant. And that was a trial, and I remember thinking, this is a great idea. Sat there as a film thinking, it just gives me an extra tactical option. And you know what? These people have more knowledge, more skill in the area, and they're the experts, subject matter experts in real. And they have access to the databases that we don't. So I was like, this is great. What a brilliant idea. Whoever's thought of this needs a pat on the back. And then it went.
Yes. And it had that thing where they can make proper professional risk assessments. It's like when people ask the police to do a fit and well check. Michael Brown, who blogged as a mental health cop and worked with the Collegiate Police on trying to improve the police response to mental health, was saying most cops can say they appear to be upright and breathing. And that's what we're qualified to do on a fit and well check. If somebody asks us, can you check they're all right?
Yeah, they're not drunk.
Yeah.
We're experts in drunkenness.
We are experts.
They're not drunk.
Yes.
But can I say that they're having the mental health crisis? Well, not unless it's really obvious. And do they have capacity? Not for me to say.
Exactly that. So you're right, having that person that has perhaps access to and expertise to do a proper, credible risk assessment, it's got to be, it's worth its weight in gold. At the worst, you do make your assessment wrong, you haven't got all the information you might have got, you find yourself at the coroner's court explaining your decision.
Well, I was going to say, there can't be many jobs, can they, where you make a bad decision and potentially you can go to jail.
Sure.
I mean, I remember when I first joined and I was on section, if we've talked about the 136, haven't we, mental health app, people that don't know it's a police officer can section somebody in public. You know, if I was doing that once every 5 or 6 weeks, I'd be feeling quite unfortunate, you know. Now we're doing it three or four times a shift.
And it sucks up resources. I went out with a journalist about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, taking him on a tour of various accidents and emergency in Lancashire. I was at Blackpool Vic with a journalist at 1:30, 2 in the morning. There was already three police teams there with people that had been detained under the Mental Health Act. Nowhere for them to go to be assessed, no professionals to assess them. And the call came through to me that there were no mental health beds available in the whole of England that night. The resources had been used up. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, then you end up with one or two police officers, potentially more if you've got someone with something really bad, like an acute behavioural disturbance, and you're having to restrain somebody. But generally, one or two police officers, they are off the road, not doing crime, disorder, or general preventative patrol you want them to do. They're sitting with somebody in an accident and emergency department somewhere in the country waiting for a group of professionals to assess that person's mental health.
But you as a sergeant at 2 o'clock in the morning would not say, don't go and deal with that person suffering a mental health crisis for him to kill themselves. Because that there and then, at that moment, at 2 o'clock in the morning, that's your highest risk. It's protection of life, isn't it?
It is. It's life.
It's minimising the risk to the public.
It is a fact that within the last decade, a huge amount of that caring for and reducing vulnerability in people that are in a dire situation or are behaving in a way that puts them at risk, that a young person leaving a children's home and being out overnight, nobody knows where they are, that has fallen onto the police as urgent business that we must respond to. And I believe personally that part of that is because as much as the police have had civilian staff and police sworn officers stripped out in the last decade, so has everybody else. All the partners we work with are in the same situation. And so between us, you have to, when that happens, you can't do the preventative work. So you end up at the emergency situation. You end up at the end of the line of responses, and that's the police, because there is a lack of capacity elsewhere.
Yeah, well, obviously all this has a knock-on effect on police officers' well-being, doesn't it, really? And it's bound to rub off. If you're dealing with other people's vulnerabilities, at some point, it's going to rub off. So that nicely brings it on to police well-being, I suppose, doesn't it? And I think we've all had experience of either ourselves or seeing colleagues that perhaps haven't been at the top of their game for whatever reason. So I was, and it's available on the internet, actually, I was looking at Police Federation well-being findings. I think it was conducted in 2020 and published in 21. And this one's particularly, actually, it's Lancashire, our former employer. The figure that shocked me before I go into it, and I just want to run this by you both, is the national response to this survey was 10%, and in Lancashire it was 6%. 6% of the workforce, 194 people, responded to the survey. Now, I don't know what their current staffing level of Lancs is, about 3,500. That is a really poor turnout, isn't it? Well, what do you think the reasons for that are?
OK, is there a distrust of the Police Federation? I hope not, because I think the Police Federation, personally, is of worth and has helped me on more than one occasion. Or is it the fact of, and I'm guilty of this, and I'll be the first to say it, if something flashes past to say, give us your views on this, I'm sorry, I'm just too busy.
Well, I think you've hit the nail.
And I hit the delete button and I move on to this.
That is the very reason I think.
Absolutely, I agree.
I think that is the very reason. Yeah, I mean, I've done this survey. I was a busy detective, but I still had time at my desk to fill it in. It took about 20 minutes. If you're a frontline, I keep saying frontline officer, every officer is a frontline now in the police, but if you're on response in uniform, responding to the 999s, that 20 minutes could be when you get your refs, and that could be the only 20 minutes. So do I have my refs or fill out this survey? I know what I'd be doing.
There's a bit of survey fatigue as well. In any given inbox,
yes.
There's surveys at least every month, more likely every couple of weeks. Somebody wants to survey something and wants your opinion about something in policing. And it gets a point where you've filled them in over a number of years and perhaps you haven't seen anything change, particularly in your life as a result of that survey. Survey fatigue sets in and it's just, what's the point of just another survey?
But if we think that in Lancashire, and I think we were very fortunate to have Andy Rhodes as our chief constable.
Yeah.
And the drive that he took with Oscar Kilo and the wellbeing work nationally, I think, has had big inroads. I know it has its detractors and people, you know,
Well, I've got some interesting stats on that, actually. 6% have responded, so I suppose we've got to take these results with a little bit of caution, don't we? Because it's certainly not a representative view. The people that did respond, 80% of them experienced feelings of stress, low mood or anxiety, which is no real surprise to any of us, really. 32% of them felt that their job was very or extremely stressful. And it occurred to me, I mean, you know, I've no secret the fact that last year I had 6 months of off with stress and anxiety for various reasons. But what occurred to me when I went back to work, and it's something I never thought about, was that regardless of what jobs you go to, it's that constant hypervigilance. Whereas you as the FIM waiting for your radio to go, or you're the response sergeant saying, or when I was on traffic, there's been a fatal, or if you sat at your desk at child protection and the phone rings, you're waiting for that to come, and you know it's going to come at some point. And that is a hypervigilance, and that is a stress in itself. When you come home, I think it takes a strong-minded person to switch off from that. And if you're a career cop, 20, 30 years of being hypervigilant, I should imagine it's very hard to switch off.
I got into the weeds about 15 years ago, and I was lucky that my family, friends outside of the job were saying to me, "You're getting a bit dark, Richard. You know, you're not your usual self." It ended up through the job, I ended up getting some very effective therapy that it helped me to figure out why I was getting a bit dark and what had happened, put it in context, and it's been good since then. So 15 years ago, there was mechanisms in place to address that crisis sort of intervention. And as a sergeant, I've done it, where you notice that a member of your team is not themselves, and you have that conversation with them, and it turns out that, you don't want to make light of it, but their life's turned into a country and western song at home, and they're coming to work almost as a refuge because things are that bad at home, and they just need to sort themselves out, and they need time and away from the job and the support that the Federation and HR and occupational health can give them. My experience is that was available, and the officer did get the time, or the officers got the time that they needed.
That's where the investment in people is. Like you're saying, you're waiting for the phone to ring, but you're not waiting for the phone to ring to someone to say, "Hey, Dave, just let you know you're doing a great job, mate." Yes. You're waiting for someone to ring you with the most horrific thing that's happened to them for 20 years, and you're doing that 2 or 3 times a day.
But yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned Oscar Kilo, and I think organisations, I think once you break, they're very good. Certainly they looked after me, and I have no complaints at all. But here's another interesting fact. 74% of people were aware of reactive services in their occupational health. So, you know, counselling, helpline services, things like that. But the worrying thing was that only 30% were aware of proactive services. That's stuff you can do before you break. And I think this is where the job falls down quite a bit. I have to have some sort of sympathy with the organisation, because I don't think it's entirely their fault. It's just everybody is on this treadmill running. And I use the analogy, and if you can find the answer to this, then you will be rich men. The analogy I use is, how do you service an engine that's running hot without switching it off? Now, if you can find the answer to that, you've solved the question of police well-being, because nobody has time to stop, stand still and reset, shall we say.
No, we can't shut down for a long weekend, can we? And no. I'll go to the lakes.
And I honestly don't know what the answer is to it. More cops, obviously. But what realistically, can in the current situation with what we've got, what can we do?
I think it's self-care. Cops go and solve everyone else's problems, don't they? And sometimes have the most chaotic lives themselves. And it's getting through to these people and saying, this is your self-care. That's available, and making that acceptable amongst the teams, where you're referring each other, or you're saying on parade, you know what, I went onto the Oscar Kilo website and I got these tools, and you know what, I looked at it and I went to, you know, I tried 1, 2 and 3, and you know what, it's really helped. Are we in a position now where culturally we can do that?
You'll both know, I remember, you know, years ago after a busy shift, you'd be in the pub, wouldn't you? You'd have a pint and you'd be going, right, Steve, I heard you had a bit of a bad job today. I had somewhat similar last week. And you'd chat about it, wouldn't you, for 10, 15 minutes over a pint. And they say, don't they, that if you've suffered a trauma of some sort, if you don't talk about it within a couple of days, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And it sits there. Yeah. And that's what we used to do as cops. And in some respects, I think well-being was better addressed then than it is now. You know, we've lost all the things that make the police a family, I suppose, haven't we? The canteens have gone, the gym's gone, lesser extent the bars and the police stations. But everything that supported your well-being has now gone.
We're largely single crew as well.
Although we work in teams, it's an extremely solitary job, isn't it?
Very.
Because I still remember at Preston, where Stuart Sennon would open up the bar on the sixth floor at 6 o'clock in the morning when we finished our last night shift. And, you know, you'd have a pint.
Yep.
And what that was, and looking back on it, what that was actually debrief. That was team debrief at the end of a set of shifts to diffuse and say, let's chat it out. Because if your sergeant came up to you with a pint in hand, you know, blue shirt undone, no epaulettes on, and said, that death you went to, Steve, are you all right? Yeah. It's not going to be, yes, I'm all right, Sarge. It's going to be, this, that and the other. And you're going to be freer and you're going to be able to put things to bed. And you're right, Dave, we miss that. And we try and manufacture it, and we try and manufacture debriefs, which are great, which I'm a big advocate of from the firearms world. But you need to debrief your staff without telling them. You're debriefing them. But there has to be a responsibility to ask yourself.
Absolutely.
And there has to be a responsibility to go to your supervisor who's also busy, or your mate on the team. Can we have a chat about that? Because I think we want, in the cops, because we deal with a lot of things and we solve everyone else's problems, weirdly, we want solutions to come to us about ourselves a lot of the time. And I think, I personally think there's a lot of self-care and where you need to say, you know what, my sergeant, Richard Horton, didn't ask me if I was all right. He's not doing it out of malice.
No.
He's doing it probably because he's busy himself or he's not right himself or something like that. And you'd say, how are you doing, Sergeant?
You're absolutely right. There is a lot of responsibility on yourself, and I've certainly learned that as time goes by.
Culturally, for years and years and years, I did 30, that allowing yourself to be seen as vulnerable, as in need of some sort of wellbeing intervention, wasn't always a thing in the cops.
No.
Strong, silent types and...
Stigma, isn't it?
Yeah, you can I can take the hit, doesn't matter what I go to. Send me to a nasty death. I'm fine with that. Investigating people doing some of the worst things to other people that you can imagine. Yeah, I'm okay with that. And you're not, is the truth of it, because you're human. And it will have an effect, and it'll have a cumulative effect on you.
But you want to be seen as...
culturally...
a good lad.
But you're right, going back to responsibility, I started to take responsibility was when I was a family liaison officer. And I was in the red because I had five jobs ongoing, and somebody said... we've got a fatal, can you FLO it? And I went, no. And they nearly fell over, because Dave always says yes. And I felt awful. I felt so guilty. I thought I was going to be judged. I'm not a team player. You know, the last 20 years of my career, policing career, meant nothing, because at that moment I said, no, I'm not doing it. But do you know what? I started saying no quite often after that, and I'm glad I did. And it's going back to what you were saying, the self-care. And
did it get easier to say no?
Yes.
And did people you were saying it to understand?
Yes, and they stopped asking me.
Because, you know what, as a supervisor, if you kept saying no to me, and I think, Dave's a good lad, he'll go to stuff, he said no. Next time I want to go and ask Dave, I might just have a check at his workload.
Yes.
And he won't be my first port of call, because... oh, Rich is a bit of hard work sometimes, and, you know, he grumbles stuff. So, path of least resistance, I'll go on, Dave.
Hmm.
And sometimes you can be accommodating to your own detriment, can't you? And you're right. And then I think supervisors then need to wake up and go, why is Dave saying no?
Oh, I can't stress to people listening to the podcast how very busy uniformed officers...
I don't think people have a clue.
And... how generally young in service those officers are. And by young in service, I mean people that are perhaps not even out of their two-year probation and working alone in a response vehicle and doing the best they can and trying to back each other up, because generally we're single crew because we want the most vehicles possible to respond to jobs during the shift.
It's like social media, isn't it? We've never been so connected to each other, yet we're never so alone.
True. Very true.
Perhaps that is a topic for another podcast. Right, well, that's it. I think we've done enough for today. We've meandered around some pretty big topics. So from Stephen Richard, thank you.
Thank you, yes.
Until the next time and the next podcast, goodbye.
Take care.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.